You're listening to Beggar's Banquet, a podcast that explores the intersection of food and music. We interview bands and artists to discuss their relationship with food, both on and off the road. My name is Lucas Samuels. Back in 2018, Robin Dan, leader of the Toronto-based band Bernice, released Puff, In the Air Without Shape. The songs were ethereal and transportive, a perfect showcase for Dan's vocal interplay with fellow band member Felicity Williams. Throw a pair of headphones on, and Puff presents new sounds and surprises amongst the sonic landscapes with each new listen. With Bernice, Robin and the band are able to craft untraditional, heady music at the intersection of pop and R&B. Sometimes it's maximalist, sometimes it's the opposite, but it's always interesting. Bernice's music is special, and it's been recognized as such. Puff was praised by the New York Times, Zane Lowe, and Pitchfork. It was also longlisted for the Polaris Music Prize. The band's new single, It's Me, Robin, from their upcoming album Eau de Bonjourno, has seen similar praise. The song is a fitting ode to self-appreciation, self-worth, and reconciliation in a time when we can all afford to cut ourselves and our neighbors just a bit more slack. Robin calls Toronto home, but back when school was in the picture, she crossed the pond to Southeast London and studied music at Goldsmiths, University of London. And before that, there was time spent in Paris, France. Today on Beggar's Banquet, we're going to take Robin on a trip down memory lane. We'll talk about the decadence of Paris, the pub culture in London, and coming full circle to make music with her friends from Toronto. Welcome to Beggar's Banquet. Let's dig in. Robin, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you, Harp, for having me.
So your parents are both symphony orchestra performers. What was it like growing up in a house around that kind of music?
Yeah, I have three parents. Actually, I have a stepmother who also is in the orchestra world. Actually, she's more in the orchestra world than either of my parents are anymore. She still works at the Toronto Symphony. Yeah, I mean, as a kid, they talked about like army brats. I was kind of like an orchestra brat. I really loved the feeling of being backstage at a concert. They would bring us to concerts a lot, actually, growing up, my brother and I, and I have a younger brother as well. I mean, I remember being bored. I remember my stepmom pulling granola bars out of her purse to help me be quiet during whatever symphony I was listening to, but it definitely infused my world. Everything about growing up with two musician, professional freelance musician parents was kind of surrounding the culture of music and then having music constantly playing in the house, whether that be my mom learning a score or just music, always music playing at home.
Was it mostly classical music in the house growing up?
No, actually, mostly not, I would say. Lots of classical. My dad loves choral music. He'll play lots of like early choral, Renaissance and Baroque. A ton of jazz. Lots of pop.
What kind of jazz were you guys listening to?
Well, my dad's the jazz. He loves jazz so much. All kinds of jazz, whether it was like super classic recordings of Miles or Bill Evans or dinner jazz, he used to call it. Like he would throw on some dinner jazz for when we would sit down, you know, piano trios or larger ensembles, big bands. And then I think that really kind of launched my older brother and I into our musical worlds, because Nico studied jazz at McGill for drums. And then I ended up going to U of T for jazz performance as a vocalist. I was really kind of, for the first chunk of my life, I was definitely just copying my brother, just doing everything he did and listening to all the same music that he listened to. And
very cool. I mean, I think that's the normal path, right? You discover, if you have older siblings, you discover music through them.
For sure.
Say, circling back on the army brats versus classical Symphony brats. I wonder who would be better behaved of those two. Probably both very well behaved.
Well, have you been watching or have you watched this new series? I actually don't know how new it is, but it's called We Are Who We Are.
I'm not familiar with it. No. Is it on Netflix or one of the streaming sites, or where do I find it?
I think we're just illegally streaming it. But it's made by Luca Guadagnino, the guy who made like A Bigger Splash and I Am Love and Call Me By Your Name.
Okay.
So he made a series about like kids living on an army base in Italy. So right now Phil and I are watching it and I'm like, oh my God, this is like the life of an army brat. It's so crazy. It's such a cool concept I find for a show.
Yeah, that definitely sounds unique. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. They're not well behaved, for the record.
Okay, so we'll give it to the Symphony Orchestra brats then.
I think, I was a pretty good kid in general.
And Nico from Velvet Underground, is that where that comes from, or they just like the name?
No, his name's Nicholas, and he was born in Holland. My dad was playing with the Concertgebouw Orchestra in the 80s, and that was the short form in Holland. They just all started calling him Nico, or maybe they knew that that was the case and that's why they named him Nicholas. But in any case, that's where Nico comes from.
I took a swing with the Underground reference.
I do love Nico. Nico, my brother, listened to the Velvet Underground and to Nico specifically a bunch. So
cool. Very meta. Yeah. And what's your earliest food memory in the house?
My earliest food memory. I mean, it depends on which house, because I grew up in two houses. I had my mom's house and then I had my dad and my stepmom's house from like the age of four upwards. So if we were at my mom's house, it would be like extreme comfort. She made stir fries and simple foods. She always talked about having lots of different colors on the plate. That was her thing.
That's a good way to get your veggies in, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Don't worry about vitamins. Just eat lots of different colors is what she would say. And my dad is a great cook. He loves to cook. So he does like 99% of the meals. And then my stepmom, Loie, will kick in with some of her classics once in a while.
What was your dad cooking?
He loves to make like roast chicken with like potatoes and veggies. And he loves a good, like, rich meal. Lately, he's been getting into endives a lot. He's been making endives. He makes them with like Marsala wine and a little bit of liquid smoke, and they're actually very delicious.
That sounds nice. Did that carry over to you? Have you been finding yourself cooking during COVID and quarantine?
I'm a baker much more than I am a cook, but Phil loves to cook. I mean, I like to cook. My stepmom has this philosophy that comes from her grandmother, which is if you can read, you can bake. And I think that kind of applies to cooking too. Like, I'm really good at following a recipe. If I see something that's inspiring, then I'll get the urge to make it and I'll hopefully have most of the stuff in the house and be able to sort of wing the rest. But Phil's really great at like looking at an empty fridge and somehow making a beautiful dinner out of that.
That's a whole nother art form.
Yeah, just I think so.
See the random ingredients and then make something out of it.
Yeah, like sardines. Okay, sardines. And then we have like some stale bread and then all of a sudden we're having like this beautiful
four-course tasting meal.
Exactly.
That's funny. Obviously at the beginning of the pandemic everyone was kind of getting into sourdough baking. Were you bucking the trend, or what have you been baking over the last
year? I hate to say it, but Phil's been making sourdough for years now, so I've been living that sourdough lifestyle.
Phil's your partner?
Yes. Yeah. What have I been baking? I'm not a super adventurous baker. I guess I make like lots of different kinds of cookies and loaves and muffins. And lately I've been actually curious about Ayurveda, which is the sort of sister science to yoga. It's the medicine, I guess, of ancient India. And there's some really nice like baked recipes in there, like an Ayurvedic muffin that's sweetened with dates and a little less sugar is good, I think.
Yeah, no doubt.
But I did make key lime pie last week and it was insane.
That's awesome.
And that's got a lot of sugar.
So, you know what? It's a pandemic. I think we all need to treat ourselves. I say that every day when my girlfriend pops something out of the oven.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, what does she make? Is she a big cook?
She makes everything. Whatever kind of tickles her fancy that day, she's constantly challenging herself, which is very impressive.
Cool.
Yeah, she made like recently made French onion soup pretzels, which were really cool. And milfa and
so she's like a real
stuff. She's getting good. She's kind of found her hobby during the quarantine, and I'm paying the price in the best way possible, I guess. Can't complain too
You're
much.
You're reaping the reward.
Reaping the sugary rewards. Yeah. I've developed a whole new addiction. It's great. Okay, so you get into music. It seems like through osmosis from your parents being around it so much. When it came time for school, so. You went to U of T, studied there, and then how long were you at U of T for?
I did my undergrad at U of T. It was my second choice. I definitely wanted to leave Toronto, which kind of leads into the following chapter, I guess, after school. But I didn't get into McGill. I was heartbroken. So I went to U of T as like my consolation prize, and I had the best time of my life, and I met all of my best friends and musical soulmates, which are now members of Bernice. So it was meant to be, for sure.
Yeah, it's a journey.
Yeah.
I didn't get into McGill either, so.
God damn. Had a horrible audition. Yeah. It's a shame.
Okay, so you meet some of the band members at U of T, and then were you making music under the Bernice moniker at that point, or would that come later?
No. I think my first band was called the Juice Box. And that was with Tom, who's now in Bernice. But no, we were just making like our teenage version of like R&B jazz and having fun and playing at the supermarket in Kensington. And there was a place called the Savannah Room on College, which we basically just took over as students and played many shows there.
Where on college was the Savannah Room?
It was right just west of what's the first street west of Spadina, the one that the little elementary school is on?
On Robert Street, maybe.
Yeah, so just west of Robert on the north side. I don't know what it is now.
I'm not sure.
It's long gone.
Cool. I'm actually reading this book called On Any Given Night by Johnny Dovercourt, and he goes into the whole history of all the DIY spaces and all the forgotten and kind of left behind venues. I don't think I've gotten to the Savannah Room yet, but maybe it's in there.
It might be so DIY that it's not even worth mentioning. Like it was just us.
Was that the kind of spaces that Juicebox was playing?
Oh yeah,
smaller DIY time. Spots.
Yeah, we played at like Andy Poole Hall and
cool.
I'm trying to even remember.
Really sticking to college.
We stuck to college. Yeah, I lived like four blocks north of where I live now. On the northwest corner of the Spadina Crescent, there's like a little low-rise apartment building, and I lived there with a bunch of people.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
So how did Goldsmiths at the University of London come into the picture?
Well, I had moved to France right after university. I got a job teaching English in the French school system, which was a bit of a not super thought through decision. I just knew that I wanted to leave Toronto. And I was ready, I think, to move away from music for a while too. I was feeling a bit just confused about what to do, how to pursue it. And so I pretty much stopped playing music for like a couple of years. I continued to write a little bit and do bits and bobs of jamming with people that I met in France, but I never really found a community there. But I did meet someone.
It can be like a bit insular in well, where were you in France?
I was in Paris.
In Paris. I've heard that it's tough to kind of, you know, gain access to the communities there, mm-hmm. Especially, you know, coming from Canada or from English speaking countries.
Yeah. I mean, there's such a strong jazz scene in Paris, but I think I didn't want to play jazz anymore and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So And the pop scene is really weird in France. I find French pop music to be very bizarre. So there weren't really people, there must have been amazing people playing music that I would have loved. Like, absolutely. I just didn't find them. And I just was starting to feel a bit lost. I was just working in a restaurant. I had a boyfriend that I was living with, you know, and I thought, what if I go back to school? I applied to school in France. And I also applied to CalArts in California, and I applied to Goldsmiths, and I just felt good about the Goldsmiths program. It felt really open. Didn't get into CalArts, which is a total blessing because it was insanely expensive. In a way, like, staying in Europe and staying in my relationship was kind of the priority for me then, and studying, finding something that I was interested in studying and finding more meaning in my life was the reason for going back to school. And then through that, I think I just gradually made my way back to Canada. I just gradually realized that I just needed to go back home and play music with the people I had met in my undergrad.
Before we get back to Toronto, I want to talk a little bit about your time in France. Obviously, land of the baked goods and butter and everything fat and delicious. How did you find the food in France? Is that something you miss?
Oh my God. I miss it a lot. Everywhere has their local bakery. And so I actually think, even now in retrospect, like, knowing a little bit more, I had a really, really good local bakery where I would get my bread. And yeah, the food scene, and they know what's going on. And it's just getting better and better. I think when I was living there, there still wasn't really like a health food as much scene, like, you know, good, interesting, healthy food. It was still quite based in French, traditional French food, very rich, very, you know, delicious and relatively heavy. But I worked at a place called Rose Bakery, which was a British owned brunch restaurant. Mostly expats worked there. And I got a job there, and that was a big part of my food world, I would say, while I was living in France, because I would just take food at the end of my shift and bring it home. So lots of salads and quiches, and there were amazing, amazing pastry chefs there too, making cakes and brownies and carrot cakes and stuff like that.
Hard stuff to leave behind, I'm sure.
I don't know. I made no money. I made like €5 an hour. I was ready to leave, but yes, the food, I have great memories of eating in Paris.
Beautiful. And so you study music at U of T, and then you find yourself at Goldsmiths. Did you always know that you wanted to be a professional musician?
No, I thought I'd be a vet, and I thought I'd be like a psychologist, and I thought I would, become like an ocean activist, and definitely thought I was going to be working with animals. But through all of that, I just kept following my instincts, which just kept leading me along this path of music, which was definitely fostered by my parents and my brother, but not pressured. In fact, if anything, I kind of received pressure to not pursue music, because they just understand how precarious it is and how hard it can be to be a freelance musician. But it was like, don't do this, go to med school. But then showing me the lifestyle of a musician and showing me how wonderful it can be and how many opportunities you have that other people don't get, to travel and meet new people. And I think I just wanted that, you know? So it just kind of happened. And I guess maybe there is something in my nature that's just cut out to make music, you know, maybe it is in some way
passed down, like genetically.
Yeah, maybe. It's impossible to tell, you know, nurture was so much part of it too.
For sure. Had you visited London before, or did you kind of go sight unseen?
We did do a big like Europe vacation when I was 10, because my dad was working in for the summer, but I don't think we went to London. I don't think I had ever been to London. I went to visit the school before I went there, after I had gotten in. So I knew that I was going. I was just going to visit the place.
You're already committed.
Yeah, financially. Yeah, and mentally. I've really discovered London. What's that?
Did you know anyone there?
I did, actually, yeah, because thanks to my job at Rose Bakery in Paris, being so full of expats, I had a couple of really good friends from London who I had worked with, and they hooked me up with my housing. I lived with my friend's mom. She rented a room in her house, which was about a 15-minute walk from school. So for most of the year that I was there, I lived in that house with rotating casts of roommates, and she was there and not there, and we had chickens and turtles, and yeah, that was a great house to live in.
Sounds like a colorful spot.
No, oh, yeah, it was Cliff View Road. I'll never forget my days on Cliff View Road.
So London has, I think, like this history, and maybe it's unfounded, but I think it's changed a lot, but it has this history of like really awful food, very heavy and unhealthy, and big drinking culture, and obviously Toronto, super multicultural, very diverse food scene. What was your impression of the food in London, especially coming from Paris?
I mean, I guess I should say that while I was living in London, I was the most poor that I've ever been in my life. So I didn't have money to really do anything. every once in a while, we'd go eat amazing Pakistani food up in the sort of north part of London. A place called Tayabs was one of my faves with friends, and that was pretty affordable. I think there is a great food scene in London, actually, and it's just gotten more and more amazing. And if I had had more money, I could have really explored it, because, you know, Otto Lengi started there, and his whole food movement is pretty incredible. And I think that there was an inspiration happening in the city of that kind of food, like just really delicious, hearty. For him, it's obviously Middle Eastern, but I think... Yeah. In the same way that in Toronto, we have these restaurants that are not really like one style of food. It's just good food inspired by many different places. I think London has a similar vibe. The pub culture, yeah, like pub food is bad, but there are also amazing pubs there with delicious food. And something I loved about it over there is that every pub would have a Sunday roast. So you could go and meet your friends at, you know, 2 p.m. and order the Sunday roast, and you'd be eating like this beautiful roast, whatever, chicken or lamb or something, and all the trappings, all the mushy peas and everything that go along with it, and the Yorkshire pudding, and just hang out all day at the pub, which was really new to me. I had never really done that before.
Why do you think the drinking culture and the pub culture in London is so distinct and unique?
Well, from what I understand, doesn't it come from sort of pre-industrial revolution, and how folks didn't used to have a weekend? And so they would just, after work, they needed that they needed to let loose, and pubs were extremely affordable, so they would just go get hammered and eat there, because also I guess it was just a part of the pub tradition that a pub would also serve food,
probably more affordable food as well.
Yeah, basic filling, you know, food. And it's still, yeah, there's still like such a huge, massive drinking culture there, which I think is really gross and unhealthy. Definitely had some like bad experiences. But and it's kind of beautiful too. The social aspect that everybody goes around to the pub and has a drink after work, and that it's kind of, again, every neighborhood has their corner pub and sort of like a community center in a way. If you can not drink 10 beers, but just have two and hang out with your neighbors and then go home.
Yeah, it actually sounds like a really nice thing. I don't know if mm-hmm. I could see myself putting back 10 beers, but one or two sounds like a nice time. Tell me about your musical experiences at Goldsmiths.
It was a nice year for me. I think I kind of rediscovered my curiosity for music again. I had gotten pretty, I don't know, the U of T jazz program is so specific and quite traditional. And although we did have a lot of freedom and encouragement from our teachers, it was, you know, it was jazz school, and Goldsmiths was very much do anything you want across the master's discipline, across the master's curriculum in music. And so I took a gamelan course. I took a sort of multidisciplinary performance-based course, introduction to scoring for film. Took a Max MSP class that I basically failed because I really was not cut out for it. And then my tutor, who's a wonderful musician named Lisa Busby, she was just really encouraging of me to make my own music. And that was what my thesis project was. It was actually to write and produce an EP of my own. And I made 4 music videos for that as well, which does live online somewhere.
I was going to ask, are those online? Well, I'll have to dig them up.
Yeah. It's not
under your name.
Well, it was a collaboration with a friend of mine. So it was like, I think it is Bernice actually, because Bernice kind of started while I was living in France. I like moved home and we released this record, and then I moved back to France when we put out our first album. So Bernice already was a thing.
Why Bernice?
Yeah, but it's not something that's ever talked about, that EP. Why Bernice? It was my maternal grandmother's name. I never met her, and I wanted a band name that was not my own. I knew that I wanted to be more of a band than a solo project, and I just find band names to be like impossible. It's impossible to come up with a band name, and we settled on Bernice somehow. I still wonder if it's a good band name. I don't know.
How do you describe Bernice to people?
Oh God. I try not to. Yeah, I really try not to. I let other people describe it, and then I'm like, that's not right.
That's good.
Yeah, we make experimental pop, I guess is what I say, the most basic thing. Experimental pop that's like heavily informed by jazz, and it, at its heart is just songs, you know, me trying to write songs.
Yeah, it's this funny thing trying to categorize music, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just enjoy it for what it is. It doesn't need
it's not worth categorizing. It's too much trouble.
Speaking of other people's opinions on music, so Puff was really well received from a critical standpoint. I read that Zane Lowe quote, a real standard of musicality and musicianship. What did you think? Like, do you keep an eye on what the critics are saying or on reviews, or how did you hear about Zane Lowe kind of talking about it?
Yeah, I knew that was happening. I don't think that I had actually heard that quote though before you sent it over. I guess I keep an eye on press because I'm human. I don't know how people wouldn't, but I'm working on like having a more healthy relationship with it, because I think it's pretty easy to get for me to get really unhealthy with it, just in terms of always thinking that it's not good enough, or it's not enough, or it's not coming from the right places, or someone else is getting better press than me, so they're better than I am. But to hear someone, to hear him say that, that's kind of the ideal, you know, just to hear someone say that they hear good musicians. I think that's kind of the highest praise you can get.
Yeah, that one, it was a cool one, because he's not trying to classify the music or anything like that. He's just kind of speaking to the quality. So Felicity plays and tours with Afi in Bahamas. And I know Tom, Dan, and Phil seem to have their hands pretty full with other different projects. How much time collectively do you guys spend together as a band working on new music?
Yeah, not very much, because everyone is really, really busy. Phil's been touring a ton with Andy Schaaf. Or had been pre-COVID, and Felicity is always on the road with Bahamas. Tom plays with many different people, and Dan is like one of the most active jazz bassists in Canada. So we do it when we can, but I think also we have this shared. Because we all went, all five of us went to jazz school. So we have this shared, this way of making music that jazz musicians have, which is don't rehearse and then play the gig with no rehearsal. And it's a really bad thing. It's actually quite bad. It means that we don't play the best that we can. So over the years we've tried to, or I have tried to, foster building in, enough rehearsal that we feel just not ready, and then hopefully at the show some magic happens. I shouldn't say we'd never rehearse. We always rehearse when we have shows, but we've never had like a every Thursday band, you know, we get together and jam. Like, it's really not that's never been the way that I've made music. It's always been because something is happening, we rehearse for it, and then that thing happens.
When it comes to the process of creating music together, are you writing music and then or lyrics and kind of bringing it to the rest of the band members, and you're constructing it together? Or do you come to them with like a fully formed kind of idea and you all play on it?
It's changed over the years. When I was first making music, I think I felt quite insecure about my songs, and Tom would help me to flesh them out and to finalize them. And then as I got more confident as a songwriter, I started to bring completed songs to the band, and I would sometimes make a whole Ableton demo with, you know, all the instruments in there. And the band would listen to that and sort of extrapolate from that, and we would arrange and it would grow into the band version. And then for this most recent record, I intentionally wanted to write songs collaboratively. So we brought, we stayed at the Gibraltar Artscape Center. I was there for a month, and the band came out and joined me for chunks of time. And that's where a bunch of the songs on the record came from. A bunch of them are collaboratively written.
Very cool. And sonically, there's a lot going on with Bernice. How do you think about recreating that in the live setting?
I've had to kind of let go of any desire to sound exactly like our album. Sometimes I would like to, and we've played around with using tracks and clocking, you know, to MIDI, having Tom and Phil MIDI connected on stage. But ultimately, I think that we make the best music when we are just making our current version of it. So the song is still the song, but it might sound quite different from the record in its specificities. Like Phil might be playing a different drum setup, you know, than he did on the record, or Tom has evolved to a new keyboard sound. I think the vocals really hold things together sometimes in terms of our live shows. Like, they are the spine of the song, and then everything else is kind of like weaving around that, at least in my imagination. That's how I see it.
Cool. I mean, personally, I always love seeing a band that kind of takes a different approach live. And yeah, the structure of the song might be there, but the approach can be totally different. And I feel like, at least from an artist standpoint, that must keep it more interesting for you guys when you're on tour and playing these songs kind of every night, back when touring was a thing.
Yeah. It can be a blessing and a curse, because if it's feeling good, then it's feeling the best that it's ever felt. But if it's not feeling good, then I'm just feeling really like vulnerable and abandoned on stage. And then I feel angry at myself for feeling that way. And then it's like this weird cycle that happens. But, you know, it's finding a balance, because I know some bands will rehearse their songs to death, and then there's no more joy when they play them live. So yeah, trying to find that balance.
So back when touring was a thing, what cities were you guys looking forward to hitting, you know, when it came to food and when it came to, you know, venues you like to play?
I kind of feel like, at least from my touring experience, a lot of American cities felt, I don't want to insult America, but there was a lot of like the same stuff happening city after city. But LA was unbelievable for food, I will say that. And like rural Massachusetts, we had like the best burgers of our life, I remember.
What was the spot? Do you recall?
I don't remember.
Maybe it'll come back if you're not thinking
about it. Yeah, I'll see if I can. Actually, you know who will know? Because this was one of your questions, was who decides where we eat. And it's always Tom. Unless he gets overruled, but it's not often that he gets overruled.
So what Tom is the one kind of on Google Maps and on Yelp trying to figure out where you guys are stopping?
Tom is the one who, like, lobby call is 9 a.m. and he's already like in the van, has the Google map ready to go to the coffee place that he knows is going to be the best coffee place at like 8:45. And you know, we trust him. He has really good taste in food. He's like a master of eating out, because he never ever cooks. So nice. He knows what he wants, and it's what we want too. The trick we found on in America, in the States, this like little finding good food when you don't know anyone to ask for recommendations, is that you search farm to table, which is such a gross term. Well, I don't know, whatever. It's nice. It's a nice concept, but like it's an overused term. And most often like something pretty good will come out of that.
That's a good little hack
yeah.
to have in your back pocket.
Yeah. You'll find somewhere that like cares a little bit more, you know?
Right. What kind of snacks were you guys keeping in the van?
What were we keeping in the van? Well, Phil loves to make, like he'll make his garage, or sorry, his gas station AeroPress. That's one thing that happens a lot, is like Phil running into the gas station to get hot water, and then he'll make an AeroPress in the van with like a hand grinder. He cares so much, and it's made my life so much better. Always coffee. What else is in the van? I mean, we love a good like TJ's snack stop or a Whole Foods snack stop, and you just get like some delicious stuff. Everyone has their own vibe. Like all five of us have different snack vibes, I would say. And like we'd get back into the van and like look at each other's stuff and be like, oh, you got less.
Critique it.
Yeah. Felicity's always sipping some kind of like herbal remedy. Or coffee.
Gotta keep the throat nice.
Gotta keep the throat healthy.
Speaking of which, can you tell me about your kind of pre-show and post-show food rituals?
I mean, like beer. Not really for me. I'm not really a beer drinker, but the rest of the band really loves beer, like good beer. So, if possible, finding a spot with like nice local taps to have a drink after sound check. And then after the show, going back there have another nice drink. Food wise, I don't really eat before. I try not to eat a lot before a show, which is sometimes not possible on tour. You have to eat because you haven't eaten all day. Yeah, I mean, we don't really have super strong food rituals. Seems boring, but we like see what's been provided by the venue and have a little snack and go on stage.
Beer seems like a good pre and post show ritual.
Yeah.
I'm sure for dealing with the endorphin rush afterwards, beer is probably helpful.
A nice beer or a glass of white wine.
Cool. I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions.
Sure.
Favorite restaurant in Toronto?
ND Sushi on College.
Food you miss most in London?
I miss the little farmer's market in Broccoli that I used to go to.
Favorite bar in Toronto?
Little Jerry.
Best pub in London?
I can't even name one.
The local one in your neighborhood.
The local one in my neighborhood. There was a nice pub, Broadway Market on Saturdays, had this beautiful pub that was like a big labyrinth inside, many different rooms, and it was all dark wood. And you could always find a little special secret nook to sit and have like a warm ale. But I don't remember what it was called.
Sounds cozy though.
Yeah.
Coffee or tea?
Depends on the time of day.
Sam James Coffee Bar or Jimmy's Coffee?
Sam James for sure.
Favorite place to see a show in Toronto?
The Transac.
Favorite venue you've played with, Bernice?
The Transac.
Your most listened to album of 2020?
Probably the new Brandy.
Cool.
Yeah.
The thing you've baked most during COVID?
Chocolate chip cookies.
Who's your favorite vocalist?
Impossible to answer.
What's your death row meal?
Probably a lobster roll.
What's your desert island album?
Oh, God. Also impossible to answer, but be like a João Gilberto has an album called Voz e Violão. I don't know how to pronounce that in Portuguese, but it's just him playing guitar, singing tunes.
Cool. Robin, what do you have coming up in 2021, or what are you working on?
Well, we're putting an album out in less than a month. We have some exciting like little album release stuff that we're working on.
What's the album going to be called?
It's called Oh de Buongiorno, and it's being released with Telephone Explosion Records here in Toronto, who are really wonderful, and Figure Eight in the UK. We hope to tour, you know, we've been talking to our booking people and everyone has their fingers crossed for future tours. We would love to go to Japan. That's a huge desire of all of ours. So if anyone has any Japanese connections.
Before I let you go, can you tell me a bit about the title?
Sure. I was just talking about this earlier today. So imagine, like, we did a lot of touring a couple of years ago across Canada and throughout the States. And when you're, you know, driving 10 hours a day, the shows are not always fun. Sometimes they're really fun, but sometimes they're incredibly, like, not fun. And different bed every night and blah, 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 blah. So basically just tour, everyone's just coping and like doing the best they can. And so we kind of got into this morning ritual where whenever we would meet each other, we would all say, buongiorno. or like any variation on that word. Like you can say it any way you want. And then when it came time to naming the record, I think I was thinking a lot about this whole, there's this this essay that Ursula K. Le Guin wrote about, called The Carrier Bag Theory of Fiction, which comes from a previous thing called The Carrier Bag Theory of Feminism, I believe. But it's basically all about the vessel, the basket, the bowl, the net, being the precursor to anything else, basically. Like before the spear, there has to be the object that can hold whatever you're hunting. So the name of the album is in reference to the fact that I'm thinking about songs as vessels. I'm thinking about music as vessels. Like a song is kind of like a basket or a net that you throw out to whoever's listening, and they live inside it for a while. Eau de Buongiorno is like the bottle of perfume that is the music.
Very cool. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing it. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Thanks for tuning into our conversation with Robin Dan. If you dug today's episode, please subscribe to the pod, rate us 5 stars, and leave a review. You can also visit us online at beggarsbanquetpod.com and follow us on social at beggarsbanquetpod. My name is Lucas Samuels. Thanks for listening.